Today we're talking about Windows Azure Storage. And this is one of those platform pieces that really become very useful as you're building out solutions on the platform. Definitely something to keep in mind as you're building, like I said, as you're building out the solutions. And we're going to go through in this particular session just to give you a little bit of a tour as to what the different services are, some of the considerations that you need to take into account as you're building solutions. And really, as I've done with previous Azure Camp sessions, we're going to go through three very specific objectives for today. The first of which, we're going to answer the question, what is Windows Azure? Right? So really get into understanding the different services that are available and how you get at them and so on and so forth. Then we'll talk about discovering the various different features and how you use those. And then we'll dive a little bit deeper and talk about understanding the blobs, tables, queues, and drives, all of which are, in fact, services that sort of make up Windows Azure Storage. So, storage in the cloud is really what we're talking about today, and that's really the premise behind Windows Azure Storage. It really is, and you heard me talk about this in the other sessions, it's your scalable, your highly available, your geographically distributed type of storage. In this particular case, very much so durable, so that once you put up your files up there in the cloud, then everything is saved there for you, and more importantly, has that concept of the fact that you can access it from anywhere at any time. The nice thing is, as we talked about with, in getting started, we talked about the fact that with a cloud platform, and specifically the Windows Azure platform, we really look at only paying for what it is that you use. And Azure Storage is really not any different. We'll look at the different types of storage and what you pay for and when, but the idea here is that as you're putting up files, that's when you get started getting charged, as opposed to when you're provisioning room or provisioning storage. Unless you put something up there, you don't have to worry about a thing, and you're not going to get charged for anything. We'll also talk about how we get access, in fact, to your storage and the files that you're going to put on there. Really comes down to the fact, as we talked about in getting started, everything in the Azure world comes down to RESTful-based web services. So really, Windows Azure storage in this case is really no different. You're going to be able to access it from either applications that you have actually deployed into Windows Azure and that are running on compute instances, web role, worker role, doesn't matter in this particular case. But you also heard me mention when we talked about this on last Monday, where you can mix and match different things that you actually have up in Windows Azure. Storage is one of those services that you can actually use regardless of where you're accessing it from. So if it's you have something that is on let's say a mobile device, or you're accessing it from a desktop client, or you're accessing it from anywhere. Remember, we were talking about the fact that different devices now have the ability to connect through HTTP and HTTPS. This is actually a perfect one of those services where you can actually access storage directly and your files directly from those devices without having to go through any additional code in order to do that. So that's really one of the nice things about that, and that you have that anytime access to your files that you need. Let's look at specifically what a storage account entails. We talked about geographic distribution, and that's really big with the compute services. Very much the same here with storage accounts, in that we choose where we put up our storage account or where we choose to put the files. And in this particular case, as we had with the compute instances, you can actually specify which geographic location you want to host your storage account. Now remember, we talked about the fact that really you want to make sure with a platform that you have everything in such a way that it's the closest and most performant for your users. So storage is very much the same in that you're going to select the data center that makes the most sense based on what people are using of your site, and so you're going to put that closest to them. The other part of your storage account is that you can actually enable the content delivery network, which even further helps place content where your users are. And we're going to talk about that a little bit further, so I won't go in there specifically. When it comes to actually creating your account and specifying where you want that account to be located, that's where you can specify if you want it to be part of the same affinity group as your compute instances, or you can actually specifically say, I would like my storage account actually hosted in this particular data center. One of the key things to keep in mind from how much you can put into your storage account, 100 terabytes per account. And if you think about it, 100 terabytes is actually a pretty large number. So that just gives you an idea of the scale of data that you can put in here. You're not worried about gigs. You're not worried about your hard drives running out of space or anything like that. You can put your data up there as you need. And, you know, if and when you hit that 100 terabyte per account threshold, effectively, there are ways to get around that. So, if that's something that you're coming up against, then let me know and I can definitely help you around that. When we talk about new features, actually these new features were announced relatively not too long ago, but really actually increased the value of what you could do with storage up in Windows Azure. The first with the geo-replication, now that's one of those things from a disaster recovery people were asking for, saying, you know, I'm not really comfortable with the fact that my data is only located in one data center, and I need to know that it's going to be taken care of. So the geo-replication feature that the Windows Azure team added into the platform now actually replicates your data into multiple data centers within the same region. So for example, if your data is being hosted in the North Central US data center, it's automatically going to get replicated over to the South Central US data center for you, so that in the event that something happens to your data, there is always that backup. What it won't do is it won't replicate your data over multiple regions, but you at least know that within the same region, you actually have additional access to that data. Another nice thing that was added is the storage analytics. Now, this is yet again one of those features that a lot of people were asking for, because there were concerns of not necessarily knowing how much is being used and when and how, and because everything, if you think about it, goes back to that pay as you use. You want to make sure that you have those metrics available to you so that you actually know what you're using, so that you're not getting surprise bills at the end of the month for something that you didn't know that you were using. So those metrics are in there now. And again, also from a logs perspective, all the requests against your storage accounts are all logged on there for you now. So that actually makes it a lot easier to see what's going on with your storage account. The other interesting feature that was added was the HTTP headers for the blobs. And that's really a feature that makes it a lot easier for some of the browsers to understand how to work with those files. It passes in, or I say it brings down additional headers that allows the browser to really work easier with your files, for things like streaming and stuff like that, so that the browsers know, that it's that kind of file type and so on and so forth. So really, really great stuff. And the nice thing is that it continues to expand based on the features that the users or developers like you are asking for. You heard me mention this earlier, but just in case you're interested, you can hit up migrateazureideas.com, and all of the ideas of features and such of people wanting to put into the platform are all going in there. The product teams are looking at it and seeing what they can do and what they can't do. So if you have a great idea, or you have an idea that will actually make it easier for you to work with the platform, you definitely want to make sure to hit up that site so that you can add in your feedback there. From a development perspective, we talked about this again in getting started, where we said, when we put stuff up in the cloud, or we put stuff up in Azure, right away we start actually getting charged. So how do we go about, making sure that we have an environment that we can test with that's actually not up in Windows Azure? So in this particular case, you actually have the development fabric. As we talked about, you saw the compute, the compute emulator that allows you to emulate the actual servers running up in Windows Azure. So the storage emulator is actually quite the same. And what it does is it actually installs a small little application on your computer that basically emulates how storage works up in Windows Azure. It creates those HTTP endpoints for you that you see in the image there that will allow you to then access that information at those URLs as if it was actually in your storage account. It does, in fact, use SQL Express on the back end, so 2005 or 2008 and above. So if you don't have that installed, when you download the SDK, it'll install that for you, so you don't actually have to worry about it. And it uses SQL Express to be able to do all of the back-end transactions that it needs to do to manage your storage. Up in Windows Azure, it doesn't actually use SQL Express. That's just for your development fabric. Now, there's one thing to keep in mind, though, when you're working with a development fabric, in that there are some differences between the cloud storage or Azure storage and the actual development storage. I have a link on there for you, bit.ly/Azure Emulator versus Storage, to give you a really good idea of some of the different things that you have to keep in mind as you're working with your dev storage that you'll have to make sure that you take into account when you move things up into your Windows Azure storage account. So really the best approach for developers from that perspective is to make sure that when you're testing in your pre-deployment environment, move your storage entities up into Windows Azure first. Then go ahead and test that with your local compute emulator connecting up into your storage account. Make sure that works. And then move your compute instances from your compute emulator up into Windows Azure, and then everything should be fine from there. So, not too much of a change of process from what you would typically do, but definitely something to keep in mind just to make sure that you have, that you've tested all the various different scenarios. Now, from a storage client API perspective, I mentioned this earlier, there's two ways of accessing the storage API. The first of which, of course, is going at the services themselves. And like we talked about in getting started, you can basically call any one of these as long as you can make an HTTP or HTTPS connection out. The other way that you can actually access your storage client is through the actual client APIs that are included in the objects when you download the SDK. So all of those are included in the SDK. They're all strongly typed wrappers around the REST-based services. So it's still using all of the same thing, except rather than having to worry about wiring up to the service yourself, this way you let the objects do it for you. Then you can use the regular .NET objects that you're used to using in order to access the storage. It's entirely up to you how you want to do it. There are some instances, obviously, where it makes the most sense to go directly at the service, but that's really, as you're doing your architecture, that's really up to you to decide what makes the most sense for your solution. From a storage libraries perspective, and these are really all of the different languages that are available today that have objects for the storage libraries. Your usual C#, .NET, Python, Ruby, all of those guys, really allowing you to, even though your actual application may not be up in your compute instances, so for some of the languages that aren't supported right out of the box, you can still go ahead and in fact use storage in order to in order to have that unlimited storage capabilities effectively. And you remember in application scenarios, we also talked about the fact that from a devices perspective, a mobile devices perspective, or any kind of device, those can actually leverage storage in order to increase the capacity that they have on the device itself. So if you're running Android, you're building Android tablet apps or Android phone apps, or you're building iOS apps, all the same, In those specific toolkits that you heard me mention in that session, there are actually already pre-built objects ready for you to use to actually use storage. So it makes it very easy to start adopting storage into your solutions. Now, of course, whenever we talk storage and everything like that, the first thing that always comes to mind is security. And I get asked this question a lot in terms of how do I make sure that what I put up in my Azure storage account is in fact secure. So from a general perspective, really, you're looking at the fact that you can either go at just simple HTTPS, which means that you're getting that security across the wire. But additional to that, your storage account is actually protected by 512-bit symmetric keys for the storage account that allow you to securely get access into that data. So if you don't have, you know, you don't have your storage account, your blob containers open up to everybody, you're going to use those symmetric keys to authenticate yourself as you're connecting into your storage services. And that's how Azure knows on the other side that it is in fact you and does in fact give you access into, you know, whether it's your blob storage or your tables and so on and so forth. You can actually get even a little bit more granular from a security perspective in that you can use a great feature called the shared access signatures in order to be able to temporarily grant specific users access into specific areas of your storage. So you have different options there to consider as you're doing your security, but at the end of the day, just because it's up in the cloud, just because it's up in Windows Azure Storage Services, doesn't mean that it's in fact open to everybody. There are sufficient security protocols in place to ensure that your data is safe at all times. Before we go any further, I wanted to just, now that we sort of covered up the idea of storage in general, let's dig in a little bit further into the actual specific services that are in fact available as part of Azure Storage. What we have are the blobs, which really is just areas of space where you can put up your files. And you can put them in with metadata and everything like that. You know, but really where you actually store your data. Now, we talked about this also in Getting Started, where there is this concept of drives. And that's really NTFS volumes that you can attach to your compute instances that effectively, when they're attached to the instance, represent themselves as a drive. They have a drive letter and everything like that. But ultimately, they're just mapping back into your blobs for management there. And we'll get a little into that in a little bit. Tables. Structured service is really just the concept of entities and entity properties all stored in a table. But remember, not relational database. That's what we have SQL Azure for. This is really just for your flat type of lots of data access organized into entities type of data. And we'll go through that in a little bit as well. And then queues, really from a mechanism of delivering messages between all of your different areas of your solution. So let's start talking about blobs more specifically. Here's basically an idea of what a blob looks like, or how blob storage works. At the top level, you have your account. So in my particular case, of course I needed to do this. I used Contoso. Then your account gets separated out into containers that effectively are what hold your blobs or your files and so on and so forth. Now you can do a lot of things with containers. You can put specific security protocols on those containers. You can access those containers via the URL to get listings and so on and so forth. So within those containers then you actually have your blobs. And those blobs are whatever document or picture or video or whatever it is that you decide to put up in your blob, that's in fact stored in your container. And then if we break down blob even further, then the blobs actually break up into either block blobs or page blobs. And we'll go into what the differences are between those in just a sec. But that's basically the idea of how data is stored within blob storage. When you create these containers and your account and blobs and so on and so forth, you actually get unique DNS names that allow you to access that data. So you'll notice in here, my account is the first one that's set up, and that's something that when I go into the management portal, there's a wizard in there to take you through creating that account. Then my container shows that URL, so that's that first part of the URL after the actual domain name, and then the blob name itself, so my document or my picture or whatever it is that it you're storing up there and needing to access. One of the things that's sort of key with your blob storage is you can actually add, as you're uploading it, you can actually add metadata into your file to allow the browser or the application that's going to be using it after you have it on there really an understanding of what that is. You know, so you'd put on the content type on it to, you know, if it's an image, then you would say, hey, this is an image, it's a JPEG, or it's a GIF, or whatever. And if it's a video, same thing. Really allows you to describe the file so that blob storage knows how to handle it, but also when it relays that back to the user that's calling it, it also knows how to interpret the file. And you can either do that as part of your put blob command, or you can actually go in and put that individually after the file is already on there. It's entirely up to you on how you want to do that. Depending on what you're doing when you're uploading or when you're putting your blob, one may make sense more than the other. Remember, we talked about this in getting started in terms of how there's multiple ways to do the same thing. Really still comes down to the architecture of your application. You know, I can't say that there is one way to do it and that is how you shall do it. It really comes down to what makes most sense from that cost perspective, if you remember. Keep in mind, when we're talking about storage, transactions is part of the cost formula in this particular case. You know, so when it comes down to cost, you're worrying about both space that you're taking up and the transactions across to your storage services. So, you know, you want to make sure that you're being smart about how you you're describing those files and how you're really putting transactions across to your storage services. Now, from a blob security perspective, I sort of touched on this before, but let's go more specifically into it. From blob's perspective, you can actually have your blobs completely open to the public. So let's say you're putting up pictures or videos that anybody can access, doesn't need specific authentication into your site, doesn't need anything like that. For those of you who attended Tech Days, when you loaded the Tech Days agenda, that was actually coming straight from blob storage. And you know, you didn't need to authenticate or anything like that. That was a public container that's available for when we put files out there. For containers that are not public, you have the ability to put access policies on a container level to really control what happens with that container. And as I mentioned earlier, you have the idea of shared access signatures to be able to grant sort of a lease, if you will, for a specific user or a specific role in your application to have access, and then have that expire after a certain period of time or have that access or expire under certain conditions. So that gives you really the freedom to have your container effectively secure without and giving people access to it without accessing it or opening it up at all times, right? So again, very much so an area that requires, I would recommend either asking, you know, the various different security experts and storage experts like Tyler, or posting up questions up in the LinkedIn group about what, you know, what makes most sense when. Or just reading up online and in various different how-to videos. But this is one of those things where you want to make sure that you understand it and understand it to all of its various different implications to make sure that you're actually choosing the right one for the right purpose. Now, I mentioned this earlier about the different types of blobs that are actually available for you. And this is yet again one of those things where you want to make sure that you understand the differences between the two, because each of them will be used in different situations. From a block blob's perspective, this is really streaming workloads. So you have these little blocks and it puts the blocks one by one, which really is really good for when you want to upload you know, multiple pieces in parallel and then construct or have storage services construct the final file for you. Does really good or does really well for when you need to retry things, or you know, if you're concerned about network and so on and so forth. So that's really a great way to go about it. In this particular case, there's a 200 gig limit per blob, you know, but again, depending on what your data is, that may or may not be an issue. The one thing you have to keep in mind when it comes to these blobs, before I go on to page blobs, is that once you set up a blob and you set it as a specific type, it's that type, and you can't change it. So again, one of those things where you should probably make sure that you understand the implications of the two, so that you know you pick the right one right up at the beginning. When we look at page blobs, then really these ones are specific to more random read-write type of things. You know, this is really where that that drive concept that I was talking about comes into play. That is actually a type of page blob. Really, you're looking at the fact that there's various different pages, and your data is included or is saved in one of those pages, and you get those pages back to construct your file. And you can do different types of locks on it, whether it's optimistic or pessimistic, and leasing on the actual file to prevent other people from being able to write to it, so on and so forth. So each one has their implications. And actually, Tyler has a great session that he did at Tech Days, and that one actually goes in a little bit deeper into this and how to understand the differences between the two. Tech Days Online will be, I think, at the end of the month, so you'll be able to grab Tyler's session from there. Let's visually look at what uploading looks like. Let's say I have a 10 gig movie, and this movie is something that I want to upload into my Azure storage. So what it's going to do is, as I'm prepping to upload it, I'm going to give it a name. And remember, I was mentioning also to give it the metadata as much as possible when you can. And you see that it actually, the first thing that I'm going to do is split it up into the various different blocks of how I'm going to upload it. And then each block is put one by one to ensure that it actually does make it to the other end. And then eventually, as I'm putting up X many blocks as whatever I need for my particular file, in the end, that's the final block list that puts together the file, and the file is now in Azure storage. If at any one point in time one of those blocks failed, rather than having to upload the entire file, I can actually just now upload whichever block was the problem. And you know, especially for a 10 gig file, the last thing that I want to do is is re-upload a 10 gig file should there have been an issue on the network or anything like that, and it required me to re-upload. Okay, so that's something to consider there. You saw, so that's that block list that I was mentioning, and then the other thing that I didn't mention yet is actually the fact that you could do things that with these blocks, you can actually do them in parallel now, and you can actually use the power of parallelism, if you will, to actually reduce the amount of time that it takes for the blob to go up. Okay, and then as I mentioned as well, you can either go in order or out of order. It's entirely up to you. The idea being that everything is organized into the blocks. When we look at pages, right, for that same 10 gig address space, if you will, you actually create the blob that way, and you specify its size. And then because you can actually put data anywhere in those pages, you're actually only going to get charged for pages that have data stored within them, and we'll see what that looks like in a second. The nice thing, again, about this particular type of storage is that you do have that random access, which means I can basically put in data wherever I want. I don't have to go in order depending on what I need it to do. I can clear in the exact same way as I put, specifying a specific page address range of where I want to clear. When I get the data back, I can actually query to see, okay, what are my page ranges and where do I have data? And then when I want to actually get the data back and I specify the page addresses, you see there, if I put in, get blob and I put 1,000 to 2048, it's actually going to give me zero for the first 536 bytes because I actually removed those as part of the operation. And then after that, from 1536 to 2048, that's when I'm actually going to get data. So you see in there in the little diagram where the data is, that's what it's going to get back. If I'm calling somewhere that doesn't have data, it's going to return zeros for me. Let's talk about the content delivery network, which really takes storage to a whole new level. And really that one is based on the fact that in order for you to get your data as close as possible to your users, you can actually leverage the content delivery network's 24 nodes throughout the world, and that includes places like the US, Europe, Asia, tons of different places, and there's actually more and more being planned as the platform is being used. Now, from a user perspective, the nice thing is that they actually have the exact same experience as they would without the content delivery network, but the difference is that they're actually going to notice the difference in performance and speed of them getting the actual data. From your development perspective, no difference. The only difference is that you're just changing the URL, and you'll notice there, rather than using whatever .blobcore, windows.net, my container and my blob name, I'm actually using the ID that when I go ahead and create the content delivery network, I'm using the ID that process gave me with a different URL, or you can actually map a custom domain to it, and then you're going to call that instead of the direct URL from the storage services. So let's see what that looks like. In this particular diagram, you see I have pick one stored in my storage account. My storage account is called Sally, and my blob name is called pick one, and my container is called images. I have a user that's coming in. They're going to connect into, before they do that, my site actually has that new URL that the process of creating my CDN gave me. And that's what I'm putting in my web pages, that then when the user is accessing it from their location, they're accessing that URL. What it's really doing is it's actually taking them into the edge location of where I've located or where the content delivery network has decided that it's actually closest to. That particular edge location goes into the blob storage and gets my file and puts it up into the cache of the edge location with a specific time to live in order to allow it to expire. And you can actually set that. Then it passes that back onto the user. Now, of course, this is all done behind the scenes for the user, so they don't actually notice all of this happening and they're not getting redirected anywhere or anything like that. Now, the next person that comes in and accesses that same image will actually only get it specifically from that edge location. Rather than having to worry about the extra hop to get it from the storage services, that edge location, that cache, realizes that file is there and then sends that right back to the user. And, of course, you would imagine that because there isn't that additional hop, then you have all of those, that performance that the user is expecting is right up there. Now, let's look at it from now the time to live has expired, and now a user comes in to access that data. Now, the edge location no longer has that in the cache, and so it goes over to the storage services to pick it up, puts that right back into the cache in there, sets that time to live, and then ships it back to the user. Now, the one thing to keep in mind here is, in fact, that image does, in fact, get cached on that edge location. So in the event that, let's say, you go ahead and you delete the image or the file or whatever it is from your blob storage, but it's still on that edge location, the first time, it's actually going to go and it's going to get that 404. So just keep that in mind. Okay, switching over to drives. Now, drives is one of those things where, yes, it's a functionality that's part of the storage services, but one of the things that you have to keep in mind is that there's really the benefit of having it there is that you're using it to move existing applications to Windows Azure that are sort of already using NTFS drives as part of the solution, and you don't necessarily want to go ahead and recode that right now. You know, does it hold the data? Absolutely. Does it go with it? You know, if the instance recycles or reboots or anything like that, absolutely. But it's not as scalable as some of the other storage services that are available for you. But if you do, in fact, have to use it, that's perfectly fine. There are the existing APIs that allow you to actually access that drive from your blob storage, be able to mount it, and then when you're writing to and from it, if you're using .NET, you can just use your regular system.io. It actually makes it just that easy. At the end of the day, it's just a page blob that's stored in your storage account, and what it does is it actually keeps a local cache on the particular instance for those read operations so that it can make sure that it actually makes it quite speedy. When you're writing, you have to make sure, as you would for any kind of buffer, that you're making sure that when you're writing, you're actually flushing it to make sure that it then writes back into your drive. So let's actually take a look at what that looks like. Actually, we'll get to that in a second. Before we do, when we're talking about the actual VHD itself, those drives can actually be up to a terabyte. And they're mounted for a single instance at a time. Now, here's one of the things that sort of something to keep in mind, because usually you learn this the hard way. A drive can only be mounted for read-write to one instance, so keep that in mind. So even if you have an instance in production and an instance in staging, you can only mount it to the one. So that actually makes testing a little bit interesting from that perspective. From a read perspective, you can actually read snapshots from multiple devices, from multiple instances. So that's not as much of an issue, but it's really the write that makes things interesting. From an instance itself, you have up to 16 drives that you can mount. Another tip there, actually, again, one of those things that you learn the hard way, is that the drives, when they're mounted, the drive letter is actually dynamically decided upon, if you will, or dynamically assigned. So every time the instance recycles, you're not guaranteed to have the same letter. However, what you can do is you can actually script it so that rather than having the drive automatically mounted, that you're manually mounting it, and therefore you can specify the letter. Or if you have it mounted, then you can actually go ahead and change the letter once the instance has booted up. So again, one of those things to keep in mind. Now, storage, as you know, you can access directly. The drives are a bit different in that you can't actually access what's in the drive without mounting it into one of the instances. Now, you can upload VHDs that you create from your on-premise solution. You can upload those, then mount those. You can even download the VHDs that are in your storage account. You can't remotely mount it. So that's something to keep in mind there. Now, from a accessing it perspective, this is one of those things where the REST calls don't exist. So you're actually going to use the drive APIs that are part of your SDK to create the drive, to mount it, to get the various different mount drives that you have, and to also snapshot the drive. Right? So somewhat different than the other Azure storage services, but you do have the API all the same. You just don't have those REST-based calls for that one. Okay, so now let's see how the drive actually works. So when you go ahead and you create a drive, the drive is formatted and stored actually in your blob storage. Then the mount actually obtains a lease, so an exclusive right, if you will, to the hard drive, and then puts that up onto the operating system and gives it a letter. Now, as I mentioned earlier, it actually creates that local cache so that as you're writing from your application, you're writing to the one drive, but underneath the covers, it's going to write to that cache, and it's going to write back to the VHD once you've flushed it. Now, for the reads then, it usually would just read directly from the local cache if it's there, and if it's not, it's going to go ahead and get it, and then when it does, is it's actually going to put it there and then send it back to your application. So you have that mechanism, and all of that is actually handled by the underlying Windows Azure operating system drivers so that you don't have to worry about all of that stuff. It's actually just done underneath the covers for you. Now, again, when it's back up into the local cache, then it sends that into your application, and you're ensuring that speedy process back to your application. One of the key things to keep in mind there is that when you're working with the drives, you have to make sure that you're flushing it in order to persist the data. And then in order to protect from other writes and so on and so forth, you actually take a lease over the drive, you do what you need to do, and then you release the lease and you're good to go. Switching over to tables, which is actually something that is more commonly used, here's basically what the storage concept looks like for tables. Again, you have my account, it's Contoso there. I'm creating tables. In this case, I have customers and I have photos, and then each one has multiple different entities that I can actually store in there. Now, notice something actually very peculiar there with the entity definitions. The schemas are actually different, and that's actually one of the key benefits of table storage, in that you can do all of these things and work with the table, and you're not worrying too much about a specific set schema. We'll get to that one in a second. One of the things to keep in mind is that table storage is, in fact, not a relational database. You can create, you can query things, you can delete things. Tables have metadata, entities have metadata, they have properties, but as you'll see in a little bit, the way that you query tables is different than what you're traditionally used to from a database's perspective. Now, from an entities management perspective, you have your usual, your usual API calls that you would expect from working with entities, with an addition of one that's an interesting one there, which is upcert, and that really is a function that allows you to push the entity up, and if the entity exists, it's going to update it for you, and if it doesn't, it's going to insert it for you all in one transaction, which is nice. Remember I mentioned earlier about costs for doing this stuff. Tables is one of those things where when you're used to working with things on-premise, you know, you're going to write to tables directly. Each record you're going to go ahead and write. But in the case of table storage, where you're looking at things like transactions that become important, then you actually, what you want to do is group those transactions together, so group all those inserts together for the entities, and then execute that as one single transaction. So that transaction can have several different entities in it and several different commands in it, but the idea there is that you're actually just executing it once, which counts only once towards what you're charged for in your transaction numbers. From entities, considerations perspective, entities are in fact limited to 255 properties, and each entity has a meg, right? So that's one of the things to keep in mind. You have two mandatory properties that need to be on every entity, and that includes the partition key and the row key, both of which we're actually going to go into in a little bit. But basically, the two together is actually what allows you to identify that particular entity uniquely, and then also works to define the sort order. The timestamp then allows you to make sure that everything is correct with the entity, and it's exposed back to you as an HTTP E tag, which then allows you to read it and get all the metadata from that. So we talked about the fact of no schema, and really that the idea being there is that every entity has its properties as name and type value pair, and each one of those can be on the in the same table as other items and mapped to standard.NET types and so on and so forth. But the idea there is that you're not creating multiple tables in order to store various different pieces of data. So let's look at what that actually looks like. Let's say we have this table, right? So I have, you know, Gina S, you have first name, last name, and birthday. But you'll actually notice that bottom one there actually is a completely different data type. I shouldn't say different data type, but different format than the other ones. Another way to look at it, too, is that, you know, I can add in another column for one of the specific entities called Fave Sport, and I don't have to worry about making sure that the other ones have that column as well. From a querying perspective, let's take the same table. I could do things like filter, you know, last equals s, and it gets me that. You know, it gets me that particular record. But you can actually do really crazy, you know, selects and joins and stuff like that that you would do with a database, right? So that's one of the key differences there between tables and databases. The flip side of that, of course, is that this then ends up being significantly faster and allows you to do various different things with it. I touched upon the partition key just a bit ago, and really that's where Azure comes in from a scaling perspective. It's going to take all of your entities that have the same partition key and actually store them together to make sure that that is as performant as possible. So you want to make sure that actually as you're working with entities, you want to make sure that every single one of them actually has the partition key included so that it can actually maximize the performance. From a scalability perspective, as you're putting out the various different partitions, Azure will look at each specific partition and see what the patterns are of usage on those, and then we'll automatically load balance based on those partitions. So when you're designing now your data structures, you actually want to be very specific in terms of how you define those partition keys, because that's actually what's going to scale. Now, more importantly, each one of these partitions is actually going to scale differently, if you will, than, let's say, another partition that is not as heavily used, right? And Azure really monitors all of that for you, so you don't have to worry about it. But in order to maximize the performance from your actual application, that's really when you, as the designer and the owner of that data, need to make sure that your partition keys are as optimized as possible. So actually, let's look at what partition keys and partition ranges look like. Let's say I have a table here. I have my partition keys as bikes, and then my row key is actually the specific title of my entity. Now you'll notice I have bikes, I have canoes, and so on and so forth, and all of them are stored together. As the different partitions are now starting to be used and they're actually getting more traffic and so on and so forth, what Azure will look at is the different partitions and then split out those partitions into actual different nodes that will then take care of scaling those partitions. So you see in there, the first node or server in the back end handles, you know, let's say bikes to canoes. And then the second one will handle everything from canoes and on, right? So now, by separating those out into the different nodes, we've now been able to make sure that those particular tables can actually scale to the demand that my application needs and also to the amount of data that's coming into it. Okay, so partitions and partition keys and so on and so forth, definitely something that you want to consider right up front as you're designing your data. Not so easy to go ahead and change afterwards. So definitely something to keep reading about and ask questions just to make sure that you have it as optimized as possible for your application. Let's look at queues now. Now, queues, again, from a concept perspective, is very much so what you would imagine in that I have something that I can put messages onto. And those messages can be whatever it is, describing whatever it is that you need to describe. So what it allows me to do is it actually allows me to have my different roles interact with each other by putting messages onto the queue. So let's say my web role or my web instance will put, hey, you need to do some sort of work onto the queue. And then my worker roles in the back end are going to be monitoring that queue to see what work is available for them. And then they'll go ahead and pick up the messages that they need and then process that work and then potentially put a message back saying, hey, I'm done, right? So it very much so allows me to use a central place to have things communicate with each other. And key point there is it actually loosely coupled, because you can actually have multiple things writing to the same queue as long as what you're describing is actually similar. So here's basically what a queue looks like. As I mentioned, I have a whole bunch of different roles that are writing into that queue. And then on the other end, the queue is making available the different messages for the worker roles, and then vice versa. Some of the details that you need to keep in mind when you're working with the queues is actually that there is no limit to the queue length in the subject. There is a limit, however, to the message itself, which is actually 64 kilobytes. You have various different operations that allow you to work with the queue. You have operations to actually create the queue itself, and then you also have operations to put messages and remove messages on and off the queue, which of course then makes it very easy to work with it. One of the key features, though, of the queue itself is that you can actually have reliable delivery of your actual messages. What that basically means is that when, let's say in my example from before, the worker queue dequeues the message, then it dequeues it and makes it sort of invisible for the period of time that is specified, so that others don't go and get the message as well. But you know, if let's say something happens in the process and my worker role crashes, then because I haven't specifically gone in and finished the message and I deleted the message, then after that invisibility time, that message actually comes back alive for another worker process to take over, or whatever other process to take over. One of the key things to keep in mind there, though, is that when you're using something like this, you have to make sure that in the event of a crash, that whatever is going to go at and pick up the message again, it has to be able to potentially take into account that some of the work may have been done, but not all. So, you know, just you want to make sure that you you keep that in mind as you're working with the queues. Now, that pretty much is a tour around, if you will, all of the specific storage services that are available, different ways to work with them, different key things that you need to consider when you're working with them. So we talked about blobs, right, those large files. We talked about drives as a way of migrating older applications to Windows Azure without necessarily having to rewrite everything. But again, key point there is you want to make sure that eventually you address potentially using some of the other storage services that are available so that you can actually get the scalability and all the additional services that come with blobs, tables, and queues. Talk about tables for lots of data, structured entities, and so on and so forth. And then we talked about queues, which is that mechanism of bringing various different messages from different instances to each other. All of which, again, with the exception of drives, you can do both REST-based calls and through your SDK objects, regardless of the language that you're using. So you're using the storage client for that. And that's really it from a storage perspective. One of the key things, of course, as part of these Azure camps is the fact that rather than just listening to me talk for an hour, there's actually something for you to go ahead and do to really kind of get it in. I don't know about you, but I could listen to videos as many times as I can, but until I actually go ahead and try it out myself, just doesn't stick. So for this particular session, you do in fact have a hands-on lab that allows you to explore the different types of storage services and how you interact with them from your application. You can download the hands-on lab from bit.ly/AzureCampStorage. And also on there, you have all of the information on how to post questions for this particular topic. If you didn't think of any right now while we're live, or if you think of something after the fact. So with that, it is that time for questions. Just a reminder, before we do that, there are in fact additional Azure Camp sessions that either have already happened or will happen. So the Getting Started with Windows Azure, Understanding SQL Azure and Application Scenarios all were last week and now are available on demand for you. And then Securing, Connecting, and Scaling is actually what we're going to be talking about on Wednesday. So join us back for that. We'll dive a little bit more into some of the specifics that you have to keep in mind as you're building out these solutions. So for the questions, either use the chat that is on your page there, or if you're the Twitter type, then use the hashtag AzureCamp, and both Tyler and I are here to answer those questions for you. and kind of get you feeling comfortable with storage services. So with that, let's get Tyler back on here. Where are you, Tyler? Let's get you back on here. Here he is. All right. And let's get you over here. So, you being the storage guy that you are, or the storage expert that you are, what would be one of those kind of, you know, you heard me mention things that you learned the hard way type of lessons. What's the first thing that you learned the hard way that comes up to mind?
Well, one of the things that I actually learned the hard way was with blobs especially, there is a lot of garbage collection and stuff that happens kind of behind the scenes on the data center side that you kind of have to be aware of. So when you start removing blob containers and start recreating the blob containers, you can't use the same name. And different things like that, they're just kind of, they start out as little annoyances, but if you don't actually try your application in like a real Azure data center and you're just using emulator and stuff like that, you won't run into these issues, and then you'll end up running into them in production, which is a very bad thing. So it's one of those little gotchas that only creeps up when you actually are running on Windows Azure specifically.
That's I could see that. I've had that happen a couple of times. Of course, it was just in test, but you're absolutely right in that it does in fact happen. Hey, question for you. I know a lot of people do in fact get confused between when they should use block blobs and when they should use page blobs. And I know I touched on it slightly, but what's your advice to people when they're considering one over the other?
Well, the main thing is that how you're going to be actually accessing the data, whether or not you kind of want to do a more streaming mode or kind of dynamic sizes of the components that the files split up into. The main difference is that the blocks can actually be of different size, and you can start increasing or decreasing the size of, depending on what you want as far as throughput of your connection. So if you're actually doing kind of dynamic streaming, you can use a block blob, but the page blobs, is you kind of specify a specific kind of array of 512 bytes or whatever it is, and it's more for kind of random or seemingly random parts of the file. So like NTFS file systems, like you mentioned with the drives, are really, really good for page blobs. But one of the kind of clarifications that I wanted to make is that you were talking before about picking whether or not you use a block or a page, and that you once you make that choice, you can't really go back. That is true when you're talking about a blob reference, but the storage itself, when you kind of cut that reference and then start making another reference later, you can make that choice again.
Ah, yes, you're actually absolutely right. Thanks for that.
Yeah, so when you're uploading a VHD file, you can upload it in a stream with a block blob and then just cut the reference and then mount it with into VHD or the virtual image with the page blob later on.
Perfect. We got our first question here from the live stream. Rich wants to know, he says, I'm not clear on whether content is distributed to 24 nodes by default or a setting, and do you pay for each node content is stored on?
That is a great question. It's not distributed completely by default. That would take an immense amount of storage per node to just automatically distribute. It's really based off of where your traffic is coming from, where as to which CDN node the contents gets cached to. And as far as pricing, I may defer that to you, Jonathan. Do you have any answers for that question?
Yeah, so again, from a pricing perspective, you're just paying for the data that you're using. And that really goes towards, actually, you know what? Why don't I pull it up right here and then we can see. I can honestly tell you I am not a pricing expert. And more importantly, this is one of those things where they continue to change it each and every I shouldn't say that. As the platform continues to mature, they're actually doing a really good job of making sure that the pricing is actually quite as competitive. So I'm just looking that up here for you. So basically, the way that the CDN charges are incurred is for the data requests that the CDN receives, and for the data it transfers to satisfy these requests. So basically, you know, you're paying 12 cents per gig for data transfers from European to North American locations. You're paying 19 cents per gig for data transfer from other locations. And then you're also paying a cent per 10,000 transactions for the actual call out in itself. So, of course, those are relevant as of today. The best way to find out about pricing is actually if you go to windowsazure.com. The specific page that I'm looking at right now is windowsazure.com/en-us/pricing/details. And if you scroll down, you'll actually, there's an entire section on content delivery. So as you're building up your solution, just make sure that you're checking there so that you have the latest. Don't necessarily rely on what we're talking about here, because obviously that it only applies for today.
Yeah, that pricing actually sounds very familiar. It's doesn't seem very much more than accessing it from the blob storage in general. So you get a lot more with the locations of the CDN nodes for barely anything as far as pricing.
Great question. All right, so we're just waiting for a couple of additional questions. In the meantime, let me ask you this. What was, when you were doing the Tech Days session, which again, as I mentioned earlier, is going to be available on Tech Days Online at the end of the month, what were some of the common questions that developers in the sessions there were asking you about storage services?
Well, it was quite interesting. A lot of the developers were getting into very specific details about what is a transaction or what is the pricing for transactions. It was a lot more than I was expecting, and now that some of the new features of Azure have rolled out in their WindowsAzure.com website, you can actually dig a lot more into how much of your account or your subscription are you using right now in different storage accounts and other things as far as like the percentage of when you're going to start paying or how much you were paying and things like that. So there's been a lot of advancement just recently as far as the website for transactions, but a lot of people were very concerned as to, you know, how much am I paying for this, just mainly because, or I think it's because it's such a huge switch now that you're looking at storage as a service, where normally you'd kind of pay an upfront cost for your storage, and you pay for a certain amount of terabytes of hard drives and network access and et cetera. But now you're using them by transactions or per gig. It's kind of a new pricing paradigm for a lot of people. It drove a lot of questions on that regard.
Cool. What about getting started with storage services? So I know obviously there's the hands-on lab for this particular session. You know, there is the dev environment. There is a whole slew of different things to read. For you, when you first started with working with the Azure platform and starting Create Solutions, what did you find was the easiest way to understand storage as it related to actual applications, not the hands-on lab scenarios that are somewhat specifically catered for, kind of pointing out the obvious?
Well, what I found very useful is not only just getting into the labs and getting into the code of the labs and demos, but actually finding some open source solutions that actually use storage and how that code looked and how those folks basically decided to use storage and in what way. One of the ones that I kind of look back to as kind of a reference point for some of the applications that I build is Windows Azure Blob Share, which is available on CodePlex. And it does a very good job of having an upload client with Silverlight as well as doing uploads from a website and creating signatures and shared access and things like that as well, and protecting blobs, as well as actually using a lot of different other features of Windows Azure, like the access control service and web hosting and et cetera. It's basically an application that's built around sharing files using blob storage, and which makes it a really good kind of example to look at. And I really look to the real world examples and the real applications that people are building in the open source community and on CodePlex and otherwise, so that I can kind of dig through the code and see like, okay, well, what decisions have they made or how are they using the Windows Azure Storage?
Cool. Well, I'm just doing a final check here on questions before we get off the air. Again, if you do have, in fact, questions that you don't that you didn't think about right now, or that think of afterwards, go ahead and go back to the page for today's session, and you'll have all the information on there on how to tweet questions for us. Or anything like that. Both myself and Tyler are part of the LinkedIn Canadian Developer Connection group, so more than happy to take questions there. And in the meantime, then, thanks so much for joining us for this particular session.